I'm Todd Siemens. I'm actually director of the Genetics Lab at Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'd like to quickly acknowledge my co-authors who have not seen this presentation at all, but it is based on a report that they helped write. If I say anything wrong or contradict our own report, that's all me, not them. And before I go any further, I also want to acknowledge all the folks who helped collect samples, who worked in the lab to generate the genetic data, provided other kind of support in the lab, the hatcheries where we got a lot of samples, and also our funders on this project. Thank you all very much for your help, some of which some of you are here in the audience. I really appreciate it. It's been a really fun project to work on. So this presentation, as I said, is based on a report. It's already finalized. It's not yet on the DFW webpage, but it soon will be. It's sort of in process there. It's certainly available either from me or from any of the co-authors. I think you can find you a copy. Figures and tables that I actually directly took out of the report are labeled as such. There's some other things that aren't in the report. They're not labeled here, but this is sort of a reduced representation of that report. There's more in there than I can tell you about today. Motivation for the study is that we really need to understand population structure when we're talking about long-term evolutionary stability in populations, and it's really critical for planning and habitat modeling for you guys if you want to know if populations are different, if you're going to lose genetics, if you say preserve one part of a habitat versus another, if they're different. The previous genetic studies on coho in the Chehalis were actually pretty limited in space. They only sampled in a couple of different places in the basin. It's really actually pretty old coho. There was a lot of effort way back in the Alazine days, so like the 80s and 90s, where they collected Alazine samples and did analysis then. Those are pretty low resolution markers. Since then, there really hasn't been a lot of work, either by DFW or any other genetic labs, on really expanding on that original work, maybe a little bit here and there, but not really a lot of work on that. And there's actually no temporal replication. One of the things that's really pretty important with species and coho in particular is to get temporal replication in your sampling because of in Washington, their life history is such that most of the what we call adults are 3 years old. And the only other age class that's out there in the Washington part of their range are two-year-old jacks. And as such, you can actually, depending on how you manage the populations, you can end up where cohorts are actually genetically different from one another. So it's really important, especially in coho, to get that temporal replication. That's one of the things that we really worked hard to get in this study. The specific objectives here were to determine the genetic relationship of Chehalis coho with other coho sampled populations in Washington state. And actually, our reference baseline for other coho in the state is pretty limited, so I don't have a lot of comparison context there, but I'll show you what I have. We also want to evaluate the population genetic structure of coho salmon within the Chehalis River Basin with regard to the subbasin with their spawning locations, and then also to evaluate the population structure between the early and late runs. So in the Chehalis Basin, there are what are thought to be distinct early and late spawning populations of coho. So we're going to look at that genetically and see if that matters. So yet another map of the Chehalis Basin. The largest sort of spawning basins are labeled in blue and green. And then other sort of things that may impact coho population structure are also on the map. So for example, dams, the two already in place and the proposed dam up here. And actually all these, they're sort of more pink on my screen, but all these other things are actually hatchery activities, part of hatchery programs. There's actually a lot of hatchery activity in the basin, and really any population structure study has to include hatchery activities. We already know from studies in other species and also in coho that the hatcheries can actually have pretty significant impacts. Hatchery propagation, hatchery program activities can have significant impact on population structure. So what we did is it wasn't me, actually sampled fish from all those locations that are in blue and green. There's also coho spawning in these smaller basins, these tributaries, and our sampling there was extremely limited to really just a handful of fish. And also there's some maize stem spawning, we just got a handful of those fish. So the sampling was concentrated in these sub-basins that are in the blue and green. So the lower basin, and sort of what I call the mid-basin, and the upper basin, South Fork and Upper Chehalis. We had return years 2017-2018, which then, because of the limited life history, those are brood years 2014 and 2015. So these are adults returning spawn in 2017, and 18 spawned in the gravel in 14-15. And they're both from the early and late runs, what we call early and late runs, and also hatchery and wild. And all the hatchery programs for coho in Chehalis Basin are operated as integrated, what we call integrated hatcheries, which means they spawn both ad clip hatchery-produced fish as broodstock and also unmarked fish as broodstock. And we sort of allow, it's okay that they also interbreed on the spawning grounds. They're considered to be a single population. So in theory, a hatchery fish from, say, the hump tulips, or an early hatchery fish, shouldn't be genetically different from an early unmarked fish because they're interbred in the hatchery and they interbreed on the spawning grounds. So we didn't need to say, for example, take a separate hatchery collection from a wild collection like we sometimes do with steelhead, where we have segregated program. They're actually two totally different populations. Here they could be combined into a single collection for analysis. So again, hatchery, we already know that hatchery production can have some pretty significant impacts on genetic structure, and there's a lot of hatchery production, a lot of hatchery activities in coho in the Chehalis. And this is a list from the sort of programs that were ongoing in 2014 and 15 when the fish that we sampled that were returning came back. So these are what was going on in the years when they were spawned. And really, most of these are still ongoing except for some of the co-ops. Those tend to move around a little bit. So our main DFW hatchery programs are really pretty much unchanged, although we also recently sort of boosted production in the Wenatchee, or like proposed maybe we collect the broodstock this fall, I don't know, or maybe it's going to start in 2020. So there would be an addition, I think that's proposed ongoing in perpetuity program. So here you have sort of the facility, the operator, the spawn timing, it's early and late, are both propagated in hatcheries. These are the broodstock source, some of these, the satsops are shared among, actually, especially satsop mates, have been shared among hatcheries quite a bit. This is the release location, and this is the release number. And what you can see is that the release number for the whole basin is actually pretty high. And for these years, it's like just a little bit less than half of the smolts going out are actually hatchery produced. And that, I think, is still probably true. So somewhere between a third and a half of the coho smolts leaving the system are hatchery produced. So there's actually a lot of possibility for hatchery impacts. And there might be foreshadowing in all this when I keep talking about the hatchery. I'll also mention this column here, average P&I. So P&I is proportionate natural influence, and that's sort of an indicator of how well the hatchery fish and the wild fish are interbreeding, both in the hatchery and on the spawning grounds. And so a higher number, it goes from 0 to 1, a higher number means that there is a really high natural influence. A really low number means that it's mostly hatchery fish going on. There's actually, around 0.5, 0.67 is not bad. That's actually a pretty good sort of target for the integrated program. A 1 is great, so there's actually no spawning in Van Winkle Creek, really natural spawning, but 100% of the broodstock that are taken there are natural origin, so that gets a P&I of 1, for example. The Wishka has a really low, it's supposed to be an integrated program, but they basically only spawn hatchery fish, and I guess not very many hatchery, or a lot of hatchery fish are seen on spawning grounds, and not very many unmarked fish are seen on spawning grounds, so it has a really low P&I. So a variability in the hatchery influence, but still a lot of hatchery activity, and a lot of possible influence on the genetics. So the way we have an early and late spawning coho in the Chehalis, but what it really looks like in terms of reds, and Baker's Church. What I've done, he provided me some red data. So what we're looking at here is sort of ignoring interannual variation. This is just new reds seen in the SATs. I'm combining all the space and all the years of data into sort of one distribution of the timing of reds seen in the SATs. And this is really just to sort of illustrate a single point, which is we have in the field a cutoff date where we say anything before this is called an early and anything after this is called a late. And that cutoff date is sort of towards the end of November. Even though there's, and at least for the SATs off of this data, which may or not be correctly displayed, there's a lot of spawning after that date. So it looked like the late fish are actually more numerous based on that single cutoff date. In the hatchery, it's actually a little bit different. So the three places where we have hatchery programs, they still use that same early cutoff date. That's when they stop spawning what they call early fish. And then they take a break for a month and then start spawning late fish a month later in December. Even though there's still actually quite a bit of spawning in the river in between those 2 days. And there's actually no clear bimodal distribution really in any of the places that I looked through the data that Kirk gave me, that we have an early and late stocks, I guess, but there's no real obvious distinction in terms of the spawning activity in the creeks. But we have these lines we draw in time where we call it early and late. The data, so now we generate some genetic data, and I'm going to show you the results. And just quickly, what that genetic data is a panel of 257 SNP loci, which is sort of a lot. We have actually really good genomic coverage. And unfortunately, our reference baseline is limited. So the only other samples I can compare them to were from Puget Sound. We're currently building our reference baseline for coho, so eventually I'll be able to put Shayla's coho in a broader context across the state of Washington. But right now, all I can do is compare it to Puget Sound coho. And then what I did is basically just standard population genetic analysis. And what that really means is there's sort of two ways I can do this. One is you can assume that the collection means something. So we collect fish in a river, and that we assume that they all are related to one another, and we're going to analyze them as a unit. Or we can analyze things as on an individual basis and let the genetics do the talking and overlay what that collection level information looks like to see what those patterns are. Now we really got to fly because she just said 3 minutes. So quickly, results. So I'm going to talk about the last two objectives first and then get to the comparison to Puget Sound. So first thing I do is PCA analysis, and what that does is boil down all the genetic information into just a couple of principal components. And what I have plotted here is the first two principal components, and it looks like a giant shotgun blast. So what the fish by themselves, their genetics are not separating into really clearly distinct groups, but if you overlay the collection information on top of that, some things start to break out. So on axis one, what it tends to do is all the late coho are on that side. And actually, those are all the late coho from the rivers where we have late coho hatchery programs. So Hump Tulip, Satsop, and Skookumchuck Lakes, which are really all Satsop lakes because we've been sharing the Satsop lakes with those hatcheries for a very long time. And up until 2011, I think, Skookumchuck was still receiving Satsop lakes. They didn't even collect their own broodstock. So first of all, those hatchery lakes, or lakes from the rivers with hatchery programs, are already sort of pulled out on axis one. Axis two is really interesting, actually. Those are, the red circle is around the Wishkah fish from 2018. The black circles around sort of everybody else, including the Wishkah fish from 2017. So the Wishkah 2018 cohort is somehow different than all the other coho in the Shales Basin. So this is another kind of individual analysis, but using a different model. It's a population genetic model. Each bar on this bar graph is an individual, and the color indicates the cluster it belongs to. So you let the data form clusters, and it allows for partial membership to a cluster. But the more solid your color, the more you belong to that specific cluster. And what you can see is that Here's your Humtulip, Satsop, and Skookumchuck leaf fish. They're different from everybody else. They're this dark red and the yellow. And they're also, those two cohorts are different from one another. The Wishcott 2017 here in green, the Wishcott 2018 here in orange. You have some other clusters, this sort of purple. They're not super solid clusters, but they're still an influence here in the Newaukum South Fork. The Upper Chehalis, that's green, more of this light green. The Hopium actually is this blue, so they're off on their own. And the Satsop River Earlies, for example, are different than the Satsop Lates. So you can see that there's structure based on subbasin, even though we're doing an individual analysis and letting the data sort of separate itself. And there's differences among cohorts and earlies and lates. And if we look at it a different way, drawing a tree, a dendrogram, there's you can see that they break out in space here too. This is with collection level stuff. You're assuming the collections are meaningful. You're analyzing it by collection instead of individual. The Black River, the two collections from Black River cluster with one another before they cluster with anybody else. Same with Coquitlam, Satsop Earlies, etc. And these numbers here represent statistical support, and there's high statistical support for, say, the Hopium River, two samples from the Hopium River to be separate from everybody else. There's statistical support for the Wishcott Wenuchi, Wishcott Lates, not the Wishcott Earlies, and the Wenuchi here, the Humtulip, Satsop, Skookumchuck Lake, high statistical support for those to be separate from others. So now I'm going to put them in context with the Puget Sound. Again, we have a PCA plot. There's two clear clusters of samples. And, you know, if you're reading the title, you might guess that one of those is the Puget Sound, and one is the Chehalis, and you're correct. Puget Sound, when you overlay that cluster information, Puget Sound here on the left and the Chehalis on the right. So they're really very different. But you also notice that there are two blue dots here. So these are fish sampled in the Chehalis, but they actually look like Puget Sound fish. And that actually probably not straight. So actually what happens through our hatchery programs is the Squaxin tribe actually gets fish through their South Sound net pens. They get them from the Wallace River or from the Skagit, and they're temporarily reared at the Skookumchuck hatchery. So these are probably fish that just escaped from the Skookumchuck hatchery, sort of got, you know, sensitized to Chehalis and came back from what they thought was home. So these are probably not strays from Puget Sound, but instead just escapees from the Skookumchuck hatchery. Those got kicked out of the analysis. So now if we do that same kind of structure plot, again, individual data, you can see that the strength of the population structure in the Chehalis is greater than what we see across Puget Sound. So all of this solid big green thing is all of Puget Sound. So that's from South Puget Sound all the way up to Nooksack. There's less strong population structure in all of Puget Sound than there is in the Chehalis River. The Chehalis River is really diverse, coho, lots of population structure. It's actually pretty amazing. So just quickly going through these main conclusions, the Chehalis coho diversity and structure has been impacted by hatchery practices. You've got Wishcott, you got something weird going on there with Wishcott. Limited inter-cohort mixing, which basically means that the hatcheries aren't using jacks, or if they are, they're not very effective, or if the spawning of the jacks in the wild they're not really very reproductive and successful. The late hatchery coho are all very similar, which is really to be expected since they shared hatchery. Those late hatchery cohos are among the three main hatcheries. And that the late early fish are most strongly differentiated where hatchery programs exist for both. So anywhere where we didn't have a hatchery program for lates, the lates and earlies actually look very similar. There's significant population structure in Chehalis coho, differences among subbasins, including the upper Chehalis. Some differences among cohorts, mainly locations with the hatchery activity, and some differences between early, but again, mainly in locations where you have hatchery programs for late early fish. And the Chehalis cohorts are very different from the only available reference collection of Puget Sound, and there's stronger spatial and temporal structure in Chehalis than there is in all Puget Sound, which still sort of blows my mind. Some future work that I'd like to do in the Shale is to get more samples from those lower spawning tributaries, especially South Bay, Johns River, where there's actually quite a lot of cove spawning. I don't have any samples from there. It'd be nice to get those in. I'd also really like to analyze a third cohort from the Wishka, just to see if they're also really different from the other two. It'd be interesting to see there. And then eventually we'll be adding the Shales to a larger reference baseline for the state of Washington. And we're working on that now. We have some funding through the Southern Fund Pacific Sand Commission, so we're working on that now, actually. So sometime in the next couple of years, we'll be able to put Shales, Coho in contact with the rest of the state. So